Welcome, everyone, to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast by Fantastic Geek. Joining me, as always, is Pete. Hiya, Pete.
Hey, everybody. I am Pete, and I am still Iron Man.
Still, after these three different Iron Man episodes. Well, Pete, before we delve into Iron Man 3, as we get oh so close, less than 24 hours away from the premiere of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., 8 p.m., on Tuesday, September 24th on ABC, and of course elsewhere if you're outside the US of A. Pete, who is our sponsor this week?
Our sponsor, Matt, is the famed Grauman's Chinese Theater. That place is the bomb.
Wow. Quite a good reference. I thought you were going to go with Advanced Idea Mechanics, although I think that would have been a little bit too, or maybe not memorable enough from Iron Man 3.
Definitely not.
Well, we are indeed talking Iron Man 3 today, and similar to our previous episode, the one from a couple days ago, we're going to flash back to the thoughts that Pete and I had after seeing this movie, and kind of let you relive that experience. And after that, we will come back having fully recapped the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and then we'll just have our final thoughts until we finally get to see Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So, Pete, are you ready to go all the way back to May 3rd, 2013?
I got my 3D goggles on now.
Ooh, here we go. So, obviously today, Pete, here we are at the end of this mammoth 3 or 4 day weekend, at least here in the United States, where Iron Man 3 has premiered. You and I saw it on Friday night, and here we are to give our thoughts. Pete, why don't you start before I throw some stats, before I throw some other various thoughts at you. What were your initial reactions there?
Really liked it. I think it is easily the best entry in the series. Shane Black brought some great energy, moving it forward from what Jon Favreau had set it up. A fitting end to a trilogy here.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And I think that, you know, everybody in the world loved Iron Man 1. Iron Man 2 was severely lacking.
Oh, it's god awful.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's some nice aspects to it, but as an overall film, it is a soup sandwich in that it just falls apart.
Well, and you know, I don't blame Jon Favreau as much as I think a director would normally be faulted for Iron Man 2, just because it was at a point in the Marvel Cinematic Universe cycle where they're like, hey, we really have to start to tie things together now, more than like, you know, Sam Jackson walking out at the end of the first one. And it was serving so many masters. It's like, you have to have, you know, you have to have Black Widow in there. Where's Coulson going? He's going to Arizona. Like, there was so much of that that I think in subsequent Marvel movies they kind of dialed back on a bit. Just because I think they saw that a huge portion of Iron Man 2 needed to be about not Iron Man 2. Whereas, to bring it back to Iron Man 3, here we are, it's the first movie in Phase 2. There's no Avengers movie to set up. We're kind of in the after effect. And I just think that it was handled so marvelously.
Well, as you mentioned, you know, the beginning of Phase 2 here, and it's a different type of narrative that we've dealt with so far with this Marvel universe. You know, I love the flashback in the beginning and the idea of, you know, telling the story with narration as opposed to a straightforward type of situation. You know, the little call-outs you got early on, you know, the scientists that ultimately you know, helped him in the cave in Afghanistan. I forget the guy's name. You know,
yes, that... Pete, did you hear the guy behind us when we went to see it who goes, I thought that guy died in the first one.
Yes, and that's why it says 1999.
And everybody looks younger and they're playing
on the screen. Yes, including Favreau with, for some reason, in 1999, a mullet. But anyway, yeah, great beginning there. And you know, as Tony Stark says, you know, I created demons, and that's really the you know, the theme of the film. And you know, again, more complex narrative for a more complex universe now. And we shall see how it plays out. You know, we'll handle the discussion towards the end here, Downey Jr.'s future as a character, after you stay through all of the credits for the post-credit scene, which I think Matt and I might agree is the least worthy of any of the post-credit sequences done to date, in maybe the most important spot yet. And we'll talk about that for various reasons. But once you stay through and watch that, they do throw up on the screen right after, you know, Tony Stark will be back. And given that Robert Downey Jr.'s deal expires with this film, his four-picture deal, you know, that's got to be decided.
Well, I mean, Pete, since you brought it up, why don't we cover that, you know, cover that right now? I mean, here we are looking at, I have the numbers in front of me. We're looking at a movie that did $175.3 million in North America this weekend. To add that with the international, it's $500.5 million, led by China with almost with $63.5 million. I mean, this has done huge, huge, huge numbers. And, you know, I know some people say, well, yeah, that's, A, it's a recognizable name. B, it's a sequel. C, it's kind of a sequel to Avengers. I mean, not really, but kind of in terms of your,
right.
Like, my parents saw Avengers. Do you think they'd be interested in seeing Iron Man 3 at some point? You betcha, because it just picks up where Avengers left off in a certain sense.
And to hinge the narrative on that, you know, Stark references New York. He's clearly, you know, PTSDing over the events. You know, I think we could get at some nitpicks later on, you know, particularly the Joe's Crab Shack or whatever chain restaurant scene where two kids come up for autographs. And yeah, that was kind of forced and really bad writing. But, you know, kicking off this second phase and then, you know, the uncertainty now with this particular character, I think is an interesting wrinkle given that Marvel seems to have all its ducks in a row.
I think that Marvel probably has plan A and plan B. Plan A is, you know, they meet on a number that they're happy with.
Right.
Plan B is, you know, a little character called James Bond, who's proven that sometimes you get better. And I'm not saying that you can do better than Downey now. I'm just saying,
right.
James Bond is the example where you sit and say, oh, the franchise is over. Robert Downey Jr. is a linchpin. Well, tell that to James Bond, you know. Would it hurt Avengers 2? Yeah, well, at a certain point, we're going to enter Phase 3, Phase 4. Some of is it Daredevil? Daredevil rights have reverted back to Marvel. Point
Correct.
Being, at a certain point, which might be 5 years from now, 10 years, 15, whatever, X-Men and Spider-Man and whatnot and Fantastic Four are going to come to this universe too. So it's a short-term problem. The Downey problem is a short-term problem. As beloved as he is, I have no problem with them paying as much as they want to bring him back. But if he decides he doesn't want to come back because he wants to go make pottery in, you know, in Indiana or something, okay, recast him. Make it a big – do what they do with James Bond. Make it a big thing where, you know, at San Diego Comic-Con or, you know, New York Comic-Con or somewhere else, you just say, and ladies and gentlemen – the rumors can be set to rest. The new Iron Man is, and they open up the, you know, out on stage comes the next Iron Man. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, and I see that, but it's a first world problem, man, who plays your lead role in, you know, your comic book franchise. Let's, you know, this is not Syria and Israel or, you know,
right.
Any other issue, you know, a topical issue like terrorism, which I think we need to address in the scope of this film. But I, for one, you know, he's the guy, you know, you link him, I think, inextricably to the character and the suit and the attitude. Iron Man to me is about attitude. Could you find another actor to fill the role? Of course you could. Has Marvel done this already? I think we need look no further than the wonderful Don Cheadle, who has been grossly underused mm-hmm. in two Iron Man movies.
Well, and Ed Norton and Ruffalo as the Hulk. I mean,
right.
The Hulk movie had the I don't want to say indignity, that's the wrong word, but the Hulk movie had the dubious honor of being the first Marvel movie to come out after one of the most perfect comic book ever, comic book movies ever, in the form of Iron Man 1. So the fact that it wasn't as fabulous as, you know, the nature of Iron Man, which is essentially Batman, but with more stuff, plus he's happy and he bangs chicks. Like, that's the Iron Man template there. Then Hulk is like, I'm on the run because I'm angry. Like, of course it was going to be a letdown. Right. But bottom line is, you're right. They've practiced with replacing Hulk. They've practiced with replacing Rhodey. Are they ready to replace Robert Downey Jr.? I don't know.
I mean, let's look at, you know, what was done this week. He was on The Daily Show on Tuesday, and he says they're renegotiating now that his deal is up. Again, Marvel is content to tell us he will be back. You know that's going to be in Avengers 2. He has to be in Avengers 2. Kill him off if you must in Avengers 2. And I know that Joss Whedon has been very open. You know, we're going to go smaller with Avengers 2, and it's about death. And in bringing Thanos in, you know, as the heavy, whether or not he will be the absolute villain or not, you know, okay, I'm fine with that. Kill him, put somebody else in the suit. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, how spoiler free do we want to let it roll here, Matt? We're assuming listeners have seen the film at this point.
Pete, after $500 million in ticket sales worldwide, we are going 100% full spoiler here. You know, okay. if thus far you haven't figured out that we're going full conversation of the movie, then stop. Come back once you've seen the movie. So,
well, at the end of the movie, to take away what essentially makes Iron Man in the, you know, mixed blessing of, you know, the repulsor technology in his heart and the shrapnel, to have that no longer hanging over his head, as if that somehow takes away the post-traumatic stress of having gone through a wormhole to throw a nuclear weapon at some kind of, alien staging area. We've come full circle. He's Iron Man, but he's still no longer Iron Man. So there's, you know, the duality there. It's a closing chapter in the character. I was interested with what they did with Paltrow. She's been very outspoken that this is the end of Iron Man, that there will be no more Iron Man movies. I think maybe she means for her. I was kind of surprised that they had let slip, and they had intended to, that she wound up in the suit at one point.
Now, Pete, here's my question for you. Speaking of Gwyneth Paltrow, I mean, she's 40 years old, looked great in the movie, you know.
Is she the most beautiful woman in the world? And that was a big conspiracy thing with people within the last week or two.
Well, my question to you, that external controversy aside, I certainly would agree, not that Gwyneth Paltrow is old by any stretch of the imagination, not that she isn't quite lovely, not that RDJ is old, but if they recast Tony Stark, you'd have to assume that they would go younger to a certain degree, if only dial him back to whatever age Robert Downey Jr. was, you know, in 2008, that would absolutely necessitate recasting her. Just, you kind of at this point, you know, if they started shooting another movie today, it probably wouldn't come out for another 2 years, or in the filming for another year, blah, blah, blah. Point being, she'd be like 41, 42 with like somebody who's early to mid 30s, you know, that just kind of wouldn't jive. So I think her number certainly could be up.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think she's done. I really don't see why she needs to further participate. You know, we could essentially Natalie Portman, you know, her Avengers style. Oh, we've moved her to the safe location with the vice president, who's not going to double cross us and everything else when, you know, all hell breaks loose within Avengers 2. It's about pushing forward now, Matt. We're going to see, you know, from an effects standpoint, how far Thor with the Dark World is going to take it. I know the early discussion on Captain America is that it's going to be this Manchurian candidate-esque thriller as opposed to a war movie. We're going to get a completely unorthodox experience, I think, with Guardians of the Galaxy. And then before you know it, 2 years from now, we're going to be talking about Avengers 2.
Yeah. It's an amazing pace that they've set for themselves starting with this, because you go spring, fall, spring with Iron Man 3, fall with Thor 2, spring with Captain America 2, and then is it August?
For Guardians of the Galaxy.
All right. So, essentially, we've seen in the next 26 months, including this month, including having seen Iron Man 3, in 26 months or so, 27 months, you get 4 Marvel movies. That's pretty incredible.
It is. And again, they have a plan. As a Star Wars guy, I'm very interested to see, now that Disney has Lucasfilm in the fold, what their ambitions are going to be beyond the J.J. Abrams helmed Episode 7, with their discussion about character-centric only films, spinoffs. If it winds up anything like the Marvel franchise to this point, I will be very, very pleased. If it is, teen Han Solo, I'm really going to be disappointed.
Well, speaking about disappointment, before we head to some of the larger issues in the movie, the one thing that has stuck in my craw since Friday night was that secret scene at the end of the movie. Now, I know that these scenes can't be as iconic as Samuel L. Jackson coming out, as some of the other ones that have fully been a springboard to the next movie, but I turned to you when the credits first started, and I said, Pete, spoiler Pete, do you know what the secret scene is? Yes or no? And I needed to qualify it like that so that you wouldn't tell me what it was. And you said no. So I said, well, isn't the assumption it's either going to be Thor 2 or S.H.I.E.L.D.? And I was so excited at the prospect of some sort of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Why
teaser.
Is that, Matt?
Well, Pete, that's because the old our S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast that we have going on over at shieldpodcast.blogspot.com and on iTunes, if you search for S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast, or search for PH Geek, that matter, that way you can find us quickly. However, if you're already subscribed to this podcast, the pop culture podcast, then you'll be getting that feed duplicated here, of course. So you're already subscribed. Welcome aboard. But I was giddy at the prospect that there'd be some sort of weird teaser with Agent Coulson somehow.
Who's dead, Matt? How could a dead character be in your teaser for a TV show?
That would be because the unequaled Clark Gregg is headlining the S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show. I personally thought, I had this whole image, which maybe they're not, I can't think of a good metaphor. I was going to say throwing the baby out with the bathwater. That's completely wrong. Maybe they're not rushing the S.H.I.E.L.D. thing, the whole, you can't have 9 women go through 1 month of carrying a baby and end up with a baby. Some things have to be done at the proper time. But
right.
I know here we are. It's May 5th, right? As I get over to my calendar, it's May 5th.
Yes.
With a week and a half from now, ABC will be announcing at least their fall lineup. Oftentimes that comes with much of the spring lineup.
And do you see how perfectly they have timed this for, oh, hey, you can't get enough of Iron Man 3? Well, guess what? Beginning this fall, beginning next January, over 3 nights of Thanksgiving right before Thor 2 or whatever it is, they're going to drop this. They have it in the chamber. I don't know if they fully have their plans for what S.H.I.E.L.D. or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or whatever. They've been back and forth on what the so-called final title is, whether it is a full-on series, whether it's a mini-series, whether it's an event, what have you. But they've positioned themselves perfectly. I agree. I was disappointed to not have that link begin phase 2 and begin this idea of, hey, man, now we're no longer just in the movies.
All I can say is, if there are any possible tea leaves to be read, it's the tea leaf that this to me would be suggestive of a January launch for the show if they want to use the movie as a springboard by way of the secret scene. Because now I'm immediately eager to see what the secret scene is for Thor 2. Is that going to be Thor related, or a springboard to S.H.I.E.L.D., or a springboard to Captain America 2? Right. I just felt like it was a wasted opportunity. And I think that based on some things I've read online, this is kind of like the first one to be a letdown, a true letdown.
I agree. I liked it in that it, again, continued the storytelling device of Downey Jr. narrating, and then you see a doctor and quick, oh, wait, that's the Incredible Hulk, but he's got a different haircut. And it continues their bromance there. And it's cute and all, but it was a wasted opportunity.
Well, I tell you what was not a wasted opportunity, Pete, which was the decision to essentially take the issue of terrorism and make that the centerpiece of your villainous story. So I guess, Pete, I'll ask you, what were your thoughts on the Mandarin?
Well, I mean, the terrorism topic has never been more prescient than right now. And between this podcast and our next podcast on Star Trek Into Darkness, it's going to be a major, major issue. And again, it's not with the idea that Disney, Paramount, they're looking to be topical here and give this to you. This is an outgrowth of what we're facing in the world. But in light of the Boston Marathon last month, you know, you and I had had the discussion before. Very interesting to see how this played out with the Bin Laden-esque Mandarin. And then for the wrinkle to be thrown into it that I did not know, that it was essentially a made-up character and done very well by Ben Kingsley in really two roles. One as the behind-the-camera Mandarin, or shall I say in front of the camera, and then as the stage actor screw up who plays the Mandarin. Nice wrinkle.
I agree, it was a nice wrinkle. I had, you know, I kind of avoid the spoilers more than you do. So to hear that spoiler Pete didn't see that one coming is, I think this is shocking news. Put it down in your in your notebooks, everybody.
It won't be the same way with Star Trek, Matt. Don't you worry your pretty little head.
Oh, good. I found it to be so incredibly brilliant to say in this age where anyone in the world
9/11. I beat you to it, Matt. Sorry, that was you, Justin.
I was going to avoid trying to say how we live in the post 9/11 era, but okay, fine, we do. But anybody living in this world now, where you know terrorism in your country, terrorism in your part of your country, can happen. I thought, what an incredibly bold decision to be, you know, because look, the Mandarin is basically Bin Laden, right? I mean, isn't that kind of
the analog? Thing, I had rewatched Iron Man this week, and I'm glad I did for various reasons. But the symbol that the Mandarin uses before his broadcast is the symbol of the Ten Rings, which is the terrorist organization that had seized Stark by proxy for his mentor figure, Obadiah Stane, in the original, and that they kept that continuity, that would continue to grow. And again, that the Mandarin is this amalgam, you know, he's got the Chinese persona, he's got the camouflage jacket a la Bin Laden. You know, is there the idea that maybe the United States had trained him, that he speaks with a very anglicized, understandable dialect, all of that. And, you know, and not making light before certainly of 9/11, but this idea that, you know, 9/11 now in the light of the Boston thing has changed. Before it was, well, that was the attack. And now there has since been another very jarring attack and investigation. And I think it is an end date and a start date into a new period here. We're a decade on, and now we have this. And the storytelling that's going to be done about that is now going to have to be reflective of that time. Before it was, you know, all right, how are we going to react to this type of magnitude and storytelling, like Battlestar Galactica and things like that in the post 9/11 era? And now it's going to be, I think, that they're even more of a threat, whether homegrown, whether, you know, immigration comes into it, you know, the idea of sleepers more so beyond the 9/11 aspect, you know, and that this guy is clearly a Brit, and pretending to be something else, and everything that goes on with that, you know, certainly it's not a predictor, but it really kind of seizes on, to use Matt's word, the zeitgeist of what's going on right now.
Well, I just found it kind of incredibly affirming that the movie spends the first half basically saying, you know, here's your Middle Eastern terrorist who, the Boston attack aside, you know, kind of is the great specter, whether it's Bin Laden, who now obviously is dead, or whoever. And then just to basically say, this guy is a fool. This guy that you fear should be feared. This guy has done bad things. And we'll forget for a moment that, you know, he kind of was just the puppet. But there are real threats out there, says the movie. But some of the people behind these threats are just fools. And if only everyone knew that, then some things would make more sense. Maybe these people would have less followers, that kind of thing. I was thinking a little bit back to having seen Zero Dark Thirty, which, you know, was about the hunt and raid on Bin Laden's hunt for Bin Laden and the raid on the compound, and just kind of the, you know, coming out of that where it's like, oh, hey, you know, hey, everybody, I guess you didn't know he had three lives and kind of had a, you know, was not hanging out in the caves. That kind of notion, I felt like Iron Man 3 was kind of just saying, you know, there are bad people out there. They can really do some bad things, but they're kind of fools, and we're going to get through this. That's kind of the message I took, at least from the Ben Kingsley role. Well, side note, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, let's talk smart writing for a moment, okay? You know, creating the Mandarin as the bad guy, but not the true threat, that was smart writing. And doing it in the way, too, I mean, let's talk about these terrorist organizations and marketing and branding and everything there. And not as if they're, you know, Disney and Marvel is putting an idea out here to copycat. They're building upon an idea that is out there in that, you know, the act is carried out and then the claim of responsibility and everything that goes on with that. And given in a weekend where E! Entertainment's website was hacked by, you know, and a claim of responsibility was made by some branch of a terror network, again, this is the unfortunately evolving face of this type of manipulation.
Yeah, I thought that for all the over the top, and I mean that in a very loving sense, but for all kind of the over the top, you know, action and all the suits and, you know, blah, 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 and kind of, you know, Guy Pearce looking handsome and all of this, I thought that it was an extremely kind of accessible, modern, in the moment movie, where it didn't need to be an analog to this event or that event, but it's just kind of like, I don't know, it felt real, where, let's say, Avengers was just like, they're giant space lizard robots who fly on giant space lizard whales. That's pretty funny, right? And cool
a
and awesome.
Clearly more defined antagonist within some twists and turns there. Again, the demons that our protagonist creates and the shadow, which, you know, from a, from an archetypical standpoint is important here, and the symmetry within the three films, you know, handled well, no problems with that there. I think they did a great job. I think there's some places, and Matt, I know you have some places where we might pick a couple nits.
Well, let's head to that right now. I think I know what you're talking about anyway. If you're not, well, we'll go to where I want to go, and then you can take us where you want to go. I remember reading an article about 18 months ago that basically said the problem with 3D is that your local theater doesn't want to turn the bulb brightness up to the proper brightness because the bulbs are like $8,000 a piece and, you know, it'll make the bulb go out sooner. So therefore, your average 3D movie is underlit. And all I know is I personally spent two and a quarter hours watching Iron Man 3 at our local theater. I am sure that it was I'm sure that they did not have the bulb set properly. I'm sure if you had the cinematographer, if you had Kevin Feige from Marvel, if you had the head of Disney in there, that they would have been outraged at the projectionist, who I'm sure is just doing the job of his corporate overlords from AMC. So I almost the 3D effects are great, but I regret seeing it in 3D because I felt that the picture, the artistry of the picture was marred by what I've come to expect from 3D, which is under, you know, not lighting the projector properly.
Now, Matt, you know, I think it's pertinent to point out that you have less than perfect sight, because I want to say, as somebody who has no problem telling you he has 20/15 vision, I found it to be fine. I had no qualms at all with the lighting. I almost kind of wonder, is it the smokiness of the glasses that maybe are giving you a hard time? Because the other thing I would endorse about this film is if you're going to see it, if you can see it in 3D, see it in 3D. I thought they did a tactful and tasteful job of incorporating it when needed.
I will agree that, and this is probably just also speaks to the direction of kind of the 3D industry at this point. There weren't a lot of those. In fact, I don't remember there being any of those kind of egregious 3D things where it's like, oh, well, I'm going to spit the water out and it's in your face. Welcome to Universal Studios. There was kind of none of that. It was just kind of like some stuff was closer and some stuff was farther away and some stuff was in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, the over-the-top stuff, you know, a missile coming at, you know, Tony Stark's Malibu home, that's both expected and I think easy to do in that medium. I like the more subtle moments of, you know, after the Chinese theater attack, the ash in the air, that kind of thing. That is artistry to me and, you know, within the mise-en-scene of, you know, the film brings you in there.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely was it was a good 3D version of the movie. I stand by what I'm saying, that it was underlit. I feel like I can name movie after movie that I've sat in where I'm taking the glasses up and down going, wow, your whites are white without the glasses. Your whites are muddled with the glasses on.
Okay.
But c'est la vie.
Well, given that we're going to be seeing Star Trek Into Darkness on Wednesday, May 15th, ahead of Most Ordinary Folks, and seeing it in IMAX 3D, that's a thesis to continue to explore in our next conversation.
I guarantee you the IMAX situation is set up properly, if only because relative to the number of 3D theaters in the country, there's so many less IMAX. Plus, they're charging you, like, I know 3D in general costs more, but like IMAX is IMAX. You know what I mean? Like they're not going to be like, you know, let's try and get a little bit more out of the bulb. It's like, no, they're happy to have IMAX movies. And then you know what? When they're not showing Star Trek Into Darkness, they're going to be showing, you know, International Space Station or whatever. Like their job is to wow you each and every single time. They need that wow factor. That's kind of like, you know, the difference between a Disney World ticket and, you know, tickets to rides at the boardwalk or something. The big one needs to always wow you.
So wait, Matt, are you saying there will be no darkness in Star Trek Into Darkness?
There will be the picture that J.J. Abrams and his cinematographer intended.
Okay. Well, while darkness is coming, I think we need to get it back on here to Iron Man 3. Let's bring up the kid play in this film. You know, Iron Man, Marvel, comic book heroes, this is a kid thing. And we have to shoehorn some children at you And we have to eat our freaking lima beans as cinema goers. Two scenes I alluded to before, you know, Colonel Rhodes and Tony Stark out at what really appeared to be a Joe's Crab Shack. I was looking for the promotional tie-in.
I'll tell you exactly what that was.
Okay.
That was that was supposed to be Neptune's Net, which is in Malibu, California. You might recognize it from a scene in Fast and Furious, the original one, where...
watch crap, but anyway.
Oh, well, I've actually been to Neptune's Net. It's not, but it's kind of one of those iconic, you drive 30 miles to go to Neptune's Net. This actually was a recreation that they built when they were filming in Miami, but it was supposed to be Neptune's Net in California.
It felt chain-esque, and hey... Let's have, let's just say two VIPs at a tall table, and little boy, little girl come up for an autograph, and we're going to continue what is a classified discussion about terror after, little Johnny, or, it's unimportant what the kid's screen name was. Asks, hey, what did you do in the wormhole? And, Stark has an anxiety attack. That was god awful.
See, I didn't get that. And maybe I just need to go back and watch it again. I don't recall them continuing to have an overt conversation about the classified material. Is it I don't remember the exact dialogue, one way or the other.
I turned to you and I said, as if they would continue this discussion in mixed company. They're talking about the Mandarin. They're talking about space aliens, the little kid. And I think that was led to be subjective. Did the little kid really ask what went on in the wormhole? Or is that just Stark's psyche in regards to what he's been through? That experience clearly changed him. Is that the cause expressly of the insomnia? Is it just a hangover effect? What was it? That scene really took me out of the story.
Wow. Some harsh words there.
Yeah.
What was the other scene?
Well, the other little kid we had to get. And I did love the banter with Stark, and that Stark would not treat him with kid gloves at one point. Refers to him with a name I'm not going to say on the podcast.
Was it also the name of the first name of the Bond girl in Goldfinger?
Yes. Yes. Without the galore part. Okay. but it was cuteness galore, Matt, with that. And okay, here, have a piece of my technology and use this on your bully, which later, we use, to get out of a tight situation. All that was fine though, okay? But when we come back to it and we've got to get the Verizon Fios tie-in at the end of the film, potato gun mark
for two seconds.
What's that?
For 2 seconds. You see, I will admit it is complete. It's the first thing your eye goes to.
Takes you out of a story. It's one thing, and again, I'm not trying to go Disney, Marvel to Paramount, Star Trek, but it's one thing, when Uhura asks for a Budweiser classic, it's not smacking us upside the head. Oh, that was product placement. That was product placement. Okay. We're going to watch Iron Man 3 in 10 years and be like, Verizon, Fios, Divx, what?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you're right. I'm thinking of some of the James Bond tie-in stuff
when you tie in the Heineken, it's timeless.
Right.
Especially as a Dutchman.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it was egregious. I mean, to me, at the end of the day, it comes down to, did you want there to be 42 suits that come and save him, or I guess 42 minus 5 because the 5 blow up in the beginning, but did you want whatever 37 suits to show up, or did you want 30 suits to show up at the end? Because Verizon Fios probably, you know, that money helped pay for, you know, another 7 computer generated suits or whatever. That's kind of how I look at it.
And that's really my last nitpick is, okay, the dronification of the suit and the idea that, oh, now we got to have one that's chunky. We got to have one for essentially every style and every purpose. We got to have one that apparently has, you know, pincher hands and, you know, different looking faces and everything like that. I thought that was really excessive. I dig that they all got blown up and we made this, you know, fireworks and everything like that. But that was really kind of, again, when you play with these characters, I think there's a fine line between, you know, homage and reverence. And then I have a new toy. Look what my new toy can do. And I'm going to, and that was clearly a screenwriter out of control. And probably too, like, hey, we have this extra money. Let's have all these suits show up.
Well, speaking of that very topic, and earlier, Pete, you used the word nitpick. There was an article making its the rounds on the Twitter sphere. It's by David Chen. It's on Slash Film. And you and I have not discussed this article. I actually don't know if you've even read it. Have you, by any chance?
No.
Okay, well, then I'm going to... His article is titled, 5 Things That Bothered Me About Iron Man 3. Each of the 5 things starts out with a bolded sentence, and he kind of goes into a couple paragraphs worth. I'm going to read these 5 bolded, bulleted, if you will, statements, and let's get your response, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think this first one in particular, I think is... I bet you'll be able to come up with the answer to his question faster than he took to write... took to write the 2 paragraphs about him complaining about it. So here's the first thing that bothered David Chen. Why does Tony Stark spend 70% of the movie trying to repair / power up his suit when he has a remote-controlled suit army at his disposal?
He did not spend 70% of the movie trying to fix his suit. I don't know what movie you watched. That wasn't the case.
Well, let me ask you this, Pete. Let's just, for anybody who might be a little fuzzy on the events, when Tony Stark lands in, it is Tennessee, right?
Yes, Rose Hill, Tennessee.
When he lands in Tennessee, you can finish this sentence. The world thinks he's...
dead.
Dead. So therefore, at least for the short term, he's trying to keep the low profile, right?
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, Pete...
It's a storytelling device.
Well, wait, I thought that too. That was my initial reaction. But here's another thing that somebody on Twitter, a friend of, I'll get the name in a second, pointed out. About 3/4 of the way through the movie, do you happen to recall what anonymous people were doing at the rubble of Stark Mansion?
Cleaning it up, man.
Cleaning it up.
He's got trashed.
And... I'm going to have the name for you in 1 second here. Come on. And it's not happening at the moment. Somebody on Twitter, whose name I will have momentarily, pointed out, yeah, you couldn't get the suits out of the sub-basement area till the remnants of the house were taken off the top of it. It's as simple as that.
I had zero problem with that in the scope of a comic book movie.
Right.
Everything there. If anything, I thought the whole, well, now we've kidnapped the president and we're going to do that. I thought that, you know, I was trying to figure out, well, what's our climax going to be? And when they held back the Air Force One stuff that they had shown you at the Super Bowl, I thought, oh, that could be a pretty compelling climax, you know, something there. And then they had the infiltration with the Iron Patriot and everything there. I was let down by the locale of where the final confrontation was. It felt like the A-Team.
By the way, as a side note, that was Jurassic Griffin on Twitter who had pointed that out. All the suits were trapped underground until, you know, the stuff was cleaned up. But, yeah, just to return to your point for a second, yeah, on the one hand, I'll admit it's not the best, you know, wasn't the best locale for the climax. Flip side, and I think something that we didn't fully... talk about. I loved the commentary that the real bad guy is just and not to wander into either Ra's al Ghul or Joker territory. But the real bad guy was the guy behind the guy. The real bad guy just wanted to watch the world burn while he's selling his guns and whatnot. And the real bad guy, there's kind of there's the line there from Guy Pearce. You know, he says, you know, I am the Mandarin. Kind of that notion of, you know, it's kind of winking at the audience, like he really has been the Mandarin all along. Aside from the whole guy behind the guy, like, you know, a la, you know, who's the real Ra's al Ghul? Is it Ken Watanabe or is it Liam Neeson? That kind of dealio going on there. I thought it was really, really well done, despite the fact that there is a Ra's al Ghul and a Joker. I don't want to say familiarity, but it's familiar territory, but it didn't feel familiar watching the movie.
No, it didn't. You know, I thought it over the top for him to have to tell us he was. I think it was, you know, strongly, explicitly stated that, all right, he had created this. I would have lost the I am the Mandarin, but I get it.
Yeah. Anyhow, back to David Chen's article, the second one I know you will agree with. Product placement up the wazoo. In addition to Fios, there's also Sun and Oracle stuff. He uses a TCL cell phone, which I'm personally not familiar with. He drives an Audi. And David Chen wonders, is that why there's a lack of a Mustang logo on the car at the end? So your thoughts there. I mean, anything you want to add, Pete?
I'm fine with the other references. You know, all right, there was a top left-hand screen Sun Oracle logo visible for a good 15-second chunk of dialogue, but nowhere near striking you as in a reveal moment. Ooh. Newness, Verizon Fios, right. Technology, you know, the ad campaign they currently have with a little kid for a science project putting together an Iron right. Man suit. Okay, that was egregious.
Yes. The third thing is, let's let a killing machine on board with the President of the United States. Here referring to when Iron Patriot with the baddie gets onto there and David Chen says, let's see. Here's the deadliest weapon known to mankind, but let's not take 5 seconds to check if he's actually manned by the guy who's supposed to be in there.
Why would you ever believe he wasn't? You had never had a situation in this universe where the suit had been hijacked. There's no reason to check it. You would think there is a biometric reason, given that technology, that would explain that away. I had a bigger problem with, why does Iron Patriot need to be on Air Force One when he can fly on his own?
Yeah, and why would you take the helmet off?
Why would you put a bodyguard that can fly next to the president on right, Air Force right. One?
Yeah, I think it's his point is a bit is stated a bit sharply. I don't think it's an entirely inappropriate question.
I think somebody's trying to make their bones off a $175 million opening. David Chen, that was for you.
Hey, we're talking about this movie too, you know. Anyhow, this next question, which I believe is fourth or fifth, WTF is Killian's plan anyway? Pete, yeah, I'll let you answer that because I have an answer.
His plan is to install the next president and to have a total connection there. Did you not get that? Do we need to draw you a picture?
Right. I mean, I'll read you word for word what David Chen
The vice president's daughter also doesn't have a limb. Could we not piece that one together too? I'm not talking about the limb. I'm talking about the plot. Right.
Here's the second paragraph from his comment on that. But aside from some quest for power, what the hell was Killian trying to accomplish? He tortured Tony Stark because Stark spurned him back in 1999. Sure, he used the Mandarin as a spokesperson just because it made good business sense. He was going to install the VP as his figurehead, and he was going to force Tony to perfect the extremist formula. And what? Why did a guy turn so nutso and evil? All in bold. All of the other villains in the Iron Man movie franchise have had their motivations better conveyed than this guy. That's not a very high bar to surmount.
No. No.
I mean, he says he wants to... He's going to put... he doesn't say this word for word, but he's going to put a Warhawk in the White House and then say, look at that bad Mandarin. Would you like to buy my super soldier stuff?
Again, it's the anti-Tony Stark, much like the Sam Rockwell character in, you know, the Schmishmortion that is Iron Man 2. It's about casting enough of a foil here, you know, one time limping, you know, not as good looking guy who puts on the Emperor's clothes and gets like Tony Stark in appearance and reputation, could potentially take his girl, could potentially take his business, could potentially take his life, and cementing his position. If you don't get that motivation, I think either A, you're trying to find a problem, or B, you didn't really pay attention to the story.
Harsh words. Here's the last thing that bothered David Chen, that disaster of an ending. And Pete, I won't read word for word, but I'll just mention he includes in the disaster, let's see, the curing of Pepper Potts in seconds, the not necessary arc reactor in Stark's chest. He calls it a rushed ending, which sets up Robert Downey Jr. as Robert Downey Jr. playing Tony Stark, but not as Iron Man in Avengers 2.
He clearly says, I'm Iron Man. It's about what the character can do. I can see why they made the decision to take it out. The tortured aspect of what he's been through. You know, we've seen over the course of three movies, Tony Stark is his own worst enemy, from, you know, the business that he owns to the demons that he has, in the second one dealing with the booze, in the third one dealing with, you know, that he's been a jerk to people, and, you know, those chickens coming home to roost. Extremis is a deus ex machina. It's a way of explaining something. No one in theater doubted the moment that Gwyneth Paltrow slipped out of his hands that we weren't going to see her again.
Right.
No one. Okay. So just as magically as that technology came to be, just as magically it does whatever the writer's fingers on a keyboard determine it's going to do. And that's the end of the story. To really expect that it's going to be linked otherwise. Now, what for me was a problem with the ending was, okay, so Pepper Potts is cured again in seconds, but then how then is it applicable to Tony's situation, given that we didn't see it used on Tony? It was never directly linked to him, but we can make that assumption that it was. And then they use a magnet to pick up the shrapnel, which had been held at bay with a magnet. You know, I think that was a little bit of an issue there. I did not have a problem with the epilogue within the film of going to the edge of my now demolished Malibu Playboy style home with all my goodies, with all my gear, and then taking the one robot that is always made fun of and putting that behind him on his little cart and driving away. Cue Avengers 2 for Tony Stark.
Yeah. Side note, I mean, yes, including that little robot at the end was like including Scotty's little assistant played by Deep Roy in Star Trek.
Keenser? It
was
like, absolutely, man. Keenser's back, yo.
I had no doubts.
He's in a commercial.
What's that?
He's in a commercial.
I thought I'd seen him.
Yeah.
Regarding, let me put forth a theory here that the movie doesn't explicitly spell out, or not, none of the three movies explicitly spell out, but I think it addresses what David Chen is saying. If you want to use your brain, Tony Stark. Okay, well, it's no question that Tony Stark is this incredibly arrogant, self-centered, you know, person, right? So when he initially puts the magnet in there, you know, when he's in the cave in Afghanistan, okay, we understand that. Is it possible that once he, you know, once he becomes Iron Man in the suit, it's now like, hey, maybe there is a surgical solution for, you know, the shrapnel in my heart, but I'd rather live on the edge with metal moving toward my heart. I'd rather live on the edge in this 110% style, and I'd rather be Iron Man with this thing powered by me. Like, would it fits with the character that he would let himself be in this dangerous position in order to continue to live this dangerous, exciting life that he has, particularly at where we're at in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where he's the only superhero in, you know, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe in the first movie. And then, yeah, as time kind of goes on, you start to go, oh, well, there's, you know, some kind of like quite strong guy from the World War II era who comes back. And, you know, there's like somebody else who's like a science experiment gone wrong. But is he a good guy or a bad guy? We're not really sure. And, oh, there's some like magic guy from another realm who like we as humans can't really aspire to be. So like, you know, Iron Man is still kind of the height of superheroes in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And that all goes away. I mean, that's like, you know,
I disagree. And I'm going to tell you exactly
right, how to bring
him back for the second one. He's a thrill seeker. How does he get the injury in the first in the first place? You know, to be in Afghanistan in a war zone. You know, yeah, it's revealed after he gets the hit, he had a flak jacket on, but his own technology went through the flak jacket. They're going to bring him back because he's bored. We're going to find that Tony Stark, 2 years on, is bored if we don't see him, you know, in a sideways of any of these other films to come. And, you know, he wants to play again. And the thrill-seeking aspect and the duality of, well, I have the curse that the thing that saves me, you know, keeps me alive, forces me to do this good. But he's the only superhero that likes being the superhero. Captain America, you know, Hulk, Thor.
Yeah.
You know, it's all with regret. It's with a heavy mantle, you know, and Tony Stark, that's who he is. He is Iron Man.
Ah, Pete, what a rip-roaring reflection that was, eh?
It's definitely the best Iron Man movie to this point.
Pete, I think that the best part of this movie, which kind of in retrospect, having talked about all these movies with the surprise bad guy that isn't the bad guy, just the fact that the dastardly Guy Pearce goes from kind of being like, you don't trust him, but you're like, hey, meanwhile, there's this Mandarin guy who's actually the bad guy. And then, no, it turns out that Guy Pearce actually is the Mandarin and that he's propped up this false front in order to, you know, manipulate the circumstances to his advantage.
It is the meme that has happened a little too often in this early Marvel Cinematic Universe that I hope Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. doesn't fall into.
Yeah, it would be too procedural, a la your CSIs and NCISs and all that, if it's like at the halfway mark, it's like, well, guys, we found who the bad guy is. It was old, you know, Slick Willy who was there using his superpowers, and then it's like, no, it actually turns out it was an inside job. Dun, dun, dun! Next week, it was an inside job. I think it'll be a bit more obvious if they decide to go that route on a weekly TV show.
Yeah, and laborsome at that.
Indeed. Well, certainly we hope between ABC and Marvel Studios and all the talent there that they can wholeheartedly avoid it. So, Pete, as we go into kind of the home stretch here before the show begins, I know we've already talked at length about the show so many times, but what are you looking forward to? What anticipations do you have beyond the general of, oh, I hope it's good?
I'm anxious to see how Coulson will reveal himself, if it's anything different than what we've seen in the commercials, and how the rapport between the cast develops. I'll tell you too, on the other side, I am dreading the internet hacker angle and just hope that is a breath of fresh air and the necessary plot device of catching the uninitiated up. Oh, you don't know who Captain America is? Oh, all right. Snappy internet hacker girl spouts it, blah, 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 or the Hulk or whatever. I hope it's not forced. I hope it's not lame.
I think that, and I'm certainly not anticipating a negative outing, but there's so many times when a pilot episode, because it carries the weight of a pilot episode to explain the nature of the show, to introduce characters, you know, it's obviously, it seems like it's going to be done with what I believe you called either last week or 2 weeks ago, or two or three episodes ago, Cocky McCockerton, kind of the average Joe guy.
Cocky, like, Everyman is the character's name.
I apologize. Cocky, yes. Everyman.
Wires O'Toole is the snappy female internet hacker.
But, I mean, usually one way in a script to introduce the audience to a world is to have a character that needs things explained to him or her. I'm thinking of Winston in Ghostbusters. At a certain point, you need somebody to turn to and say, oh, this is how the this works. This is how the that works. This is how you empty a trap and, you know, all that.
I just hope that that construction there is not the equivalent of having things explained to you like you're slow or, you know, unable to hear. Like, yelling it louder would help you understand it.
Well, I mean, let's not forget, this is a show that is directly made possible by the fact that in the Iron Man post-credit sequence, they didn't talk down to the audience. Because if you were just went to go see that movie and had no understanding of Iron Man at all, or of the of the Marvel Universe, you're just like, hey, whether you're taking your kids or you're taking your grandkids, or you're just like, I'm not really into comics, but I like, you know, this is supposed to be a good movie. And then some guy walks out and says, you know, oh, blah, blah, blah. It would mean nothing to you. This is a show that is a product of a tightly knit universe that can still breathe enough to have its parts be independent. And I really have to think that aesthetic will continue, that it's not going to, you know, it'll kind of live under that spirit or that umbrella.
Hey, we're going to let the proof be in the pudding, man. That's the hallmark of the PH Geek podcast, is we're going to call it as it is, not as we see it.
I almost am feeling nervous because the anticipation, I feel like a kid before Christmas morning, but there's also the possibility, you know, that the present won't be there. Because as I said, you know, sometimes a TV pilot can misfire a bit. And I think if there are any tweaks to be made, you know, they'd make it quick enough, but still you kind of like, you want to start with big momentum. You want to say that was a fun pilot. That really was indicative of where we went. But I guess we'll see, Pete.
We've podcasted two pretty good pilots to this point, and that we're on our third show here should tell you that, you know, how you start isn't always how you end.
Very true. You know, sometimes it's the audience as a whole that doesn't buy a show. Sometimes it's, frankly, us that doesn't buy a show. I hope that this is the sweet spot where it finds a big audience. It finds a vocal audience, you know, that it's not kind of, oh, I sit on the couch and this is the show where I can veg out. That's frankly not the kind of show I'm hoping for. That's not the kind of show I would want to watch. We all have busy lives, and sure, I have my veg out time on the TV, but I want to be actively engaged with this show. I want to be, you know, I want to be having a dialogue, not just with you, Pete, on the podcast. I want to be checking the website to see what other people have commented. I want to be, whether it's people talking to us on Twitter, us seeing what other people have to say. You know, I'm not trying to put us at the top of the communication pile at all. I want to get back to the kind of show where there's a big vocal fan base that loves the show, even, you know, warts and all, where you can call the warts warts, but just can really get behind the show. And there's a big show community out there. That's what I'm hoping for.
I think we're going to get that.
Let's hope so. I mean, we'll be tuning in you know, about 24 hours, and we'll find out. So with that, Pete, I guess this is the end of the preview phase of the podcast. Do you have any final bits of a preview before, you know, first I sign off, then you?
I'm ready for phase two.
Oh, excellent. Well, on that note, a quick reminder, do share your feedback. We have some new contact info heading into Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on Twitter. We are Fantastic Geek. That's with a PH. You can send an email to fantasticgeek@gmail.com. You can call the listener line, leave a message, 732-707-1815. And lastly, you can visit the webpage, shieldpodcast.blogspot.com, and leave a comment there. And let's jump on in, guys. I'm ready. Pete's ready. Hopefully all the listeners are ready. And adios, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow. Pete, what is your final word?
Matt, I can appreciate that you would tell me your hopes and thoughts about Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but I'm just not that kind of doctor.